set my Bible down and almost left it. Okay, so some of you will know that I finished Ephesians and then went away, and so I'm about to start an Old Testament storyline. We're going to jump into Elijah, thus these are the days of Elijah. But before we do that, I'm going to ask a couple questions, and somewhere along there today, if it seems like we get a history lesson, I'm sorry about that. That's not usually my want, but if we're going to do this stuff right, then you're going to have to know where we're headed. And so let's do this. There's two questions in the text today that I'm going to focus on. I know there's more. There's a lot in this text, but there's two questions I want to focus on that as you think about this, I want you to think about, can God sustain life beyond any circumstance? And two, have you ever had a head of steam going so much that you just are difficult to interrupt? I could tell you this. Some of you know me and you've heard me talk about it. I know that I get a head of steam going. And when I was a kid, the only way I can describe the way that I wrestled or did that, and I can talk to you because you got a kid that's wrestling, is that I would get injured and I'd come back early and I was really too stupid to stop. Right? And so I had a head of steam going and, sort of breakneck pace. Are you that person? Don't raise your hand. This is a rhetorical question where you get to leave your hands in your pocket. Do you get a head of steam going? Do you need interruption every once in a while before you get to destruction? Yes. Okay. So I had a friend a couple of years ago, several years ago, actually. I was asked to direct a retreat, and I was picking the co-chair, and God led me to Tom. Well, Tom, some of you may know Tom. I don't know if you do or not. Tom is the most mild, humble guy I know. He really is. Now, that doesn't mean he's weak. He's mild in manner, and lots of people know this. He's an engineer, but he's just kind of this way. And I said to Tom, I said, I really feel like God's asking me to do this, and I was wondering if you'd pray about it. But before you say yes, I need you to ask yourself and God this question. If Dave has a head of steam up, can you interrupt him? Because if you don't think you can interrupt me when I'm going full blown and I need to be interrupted, don't say yes here. Because I'll need you to do that somewhere. And he came back and did that. And he did interrupt me several times long before I got a good head of steam going. That's what wisdom does in friends. And so here we go. We're going to go into this text. I need to tell you some stuff before we... The text for today is in 1 Kings 17, but in order to do that, I need you to hear 1 Kings 16 just a little bit. This is the story of Ahab. Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord. Have you heard that when you've read 1 Kings and the Kings books and the Chronicles books? You see this often. So-and-so was king and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. It becomes sort of an epitaph for the kings of Israel that don't do very well. They lead in false worship. This king, however, has a little more to his epitaph than that. More than all who were before him, and as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. Do you recognize that? Do you know who Jeroboam is? Do you know the history around that? There's enough blank stares out there, I'll just do it anyway. This is the thing. So Solomon, you all have heard of Solomon, so great in his glory. The Bible actually never says anything seriously positive about him after his death again. But Solomon had a son, and his son, and I was just going to say was an idiot in comparison. But maybe he was immature and he was the son. And so he had a son and an enemy and their names rhyme. So his son was Rehoboam and his enemy was Jeroboam. And Jeroboam was exiled during the reign of Solomon, but then came back because he had led a revolt against Solomon. Do you know what a revolt is? A revolt is a rebellion that doesn't make it. And so he didn't make it, but he's about to lead a revolution, right? Because the revolution does that. And they come to Jeroboam, who's been heavily taxing them, or Rehoboam, who's been heavily taxing them, and they say, we need you to change. What do you say? And he says, well, you give me 3 days and come back. And so when he comes back, this is what Rehoboam says to the people who are about to overthrow him and are seriously unhappy. He says, my father laid heavy burdens on you, but I'm going to make them heavier. My father beat you with whips. I'm going to beat you with scorpions. Like I said, he was either immature or an idiot. And Jeroboam then says this in front of the people, down with the dynasty of David, we have no interest in the son of Jesse. Now I want you to understand that Rehoboam is a son of Jesse, but that's not what's happening here when he says that, down with the dynasty of David. The reason David had a dynasty was because there's somebody coming who's greater than David. The son of Jesse, who's also the root of Jesse, is coming. And so right at the beginning, Jeroboam starts to repudiate the work of God in the people of Israel. And he splits the kingdom in two. It sort of sounds, you know, in churches we do this. When we have a disagreement, we sort of go our separate ways. We make our own churches. And pretty soon, you'll notice that sort of seed foments in the northern kingdoms. But Israel is split, not down the middle, but 11 to 1. 11 tribes go with Jeroboam, and one stays with Rehoboam. And then Jeroboam starts to say to himself, well, you know, the heart of this kingdom is in the temple of Jerusalem. And if the people are always going to Jerusalem to worship their Lord, their God, under the kingship of this other guy, pretty soon they're going to go back. And so I'm going to do something to make sure that doesn't happen. And so he makes two golden calves. And he sets them one up in the north and one in the south. And the one in the south is in Beth-El, the house of God. And what he's trying to do is he's saying, don't go worship at the temple. Worship these golden calves. Well, what do you know about Israel's history with a golden calf? Moses is up on the hill getting the Ten Commandments. And what are they doing? Worshiping a golden calf. And God is going to break out against them and destroy them and start over with Moses. And Moses pleads with them, with God, for their sake. By the way, the kingdom of Israel was never founded on the law from that moment forward. It was always founded on grace, because they should have been destroyed. And even though they get the Ten Commandments and they're saying, we don't want to be in charge of our own lives, we want to do it God's way, their whole basis is that God has been gracious and merciful on them and not destroyed them because they worship the golden calf. But Jeroboam then makes that, and he puts it down there in the south so that they can all go there in a place called the House of God, which, by the way, had some other stuff going on in it that was really big and powerful in the history of Israel. And so Beth-El, the House of God. There's more and more and more, but his goal is to block true worship and to build a kingdom that doesn't leave outside its borders. And it gets worse from there. It gets worse. His son rules for 2 years and is killed by a guy named Baasha. Don't worry about this. There's not going to be a test at the end of the service about these names. And you'll notice that the traditional way of saying Baal is Baal, but the way I've been taught in the original language is you pronounce all the vowels. It's sort of like Hawaiian. You just pronounce all the vowels. And so that's why I'll be saying Baal. So if that drives you nuts, I'm sorry. It's not a very long trip for me. Baasha did something else. He started to build a wall at Ramah to keep people from going into the southern kingdom. So not only is he stopping the worship, Baasha is now trying to stop access. And so it gets worse and ickier. And you start to hear this. I want you to hear this. On top of that, Baasha killed Nadab, Jeroboam's son, and all the family just to make sure that there wouldn't be another king from that line. And then Baasha had a son, Elah, who ruled for 2 years. You know, things are starting to go really fast now. They're going fast. And Zimri killed Elah and ruled for 7 days after killing Elah's family. 7 days. Isn't this awesome? So we're sort of in a breakneck pace of difficult times. We've got a freight train with no brakes going on. They're starting to go against and undo all the work that God does. And then Omri comes along, and Omri comes in, but he only gets half the kingdom in the beginning. I'm just going through this so you know what's going on. He and Tibni each rule for 6 years, and then Omri kills Tibni, and he's the king for another 6 years. And Omri is Ahab's dad. And so Ahab comes in, and he does this thing, okay? So he's got this factious country that's sort of undoing all the work of God, and here's the rest of this story of this thing here. So, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians. And he went and served Baal and worshipped him. That is Ahab, the king. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah, another site of worship. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. Wow. Just let that sink in just a moment. This is not the seat you want to be sitting in when it comes time to talk to God. You've done more to provoke God than anybody else. Yeah, boy. And in his days, this is a little footnote, and it seems like a little thing, but it's a great big thing. Hiel built of Bethel built Jericho, and he laid its foundation at the cost of Ibrahim his son, and set up the gates at the cost of his son Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which was spoken by Joshua son of Nun. Why is that little tidbit thrown in there? Because Jericho was the first gateway to the people coming into the land, and God destroyed it. They didn't beat Jericho in battle. God did it. And it was said, don't build this back up. If you do, it's going to cost you your kids. But more than that, you're actually starting to say, we don't really want the kingdom the way that God says. And he married Jezebel, a Sidonian. Sidon is the center, the heartbeat of Baal worship. Now, it's time for a second deep breath. There's the end of the history lesson. Are you ready? Now we're ready for this thing, because into this situation comes Elijah, our text. Now Elijah, the Tishbite of Tishbe, it makes sense that he's the Tishbite from Tishbe, because if you're going to be from Tishbe, you're a Tishbite. In Gilead said to Ahab, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, before whom I stand, there shall be neither dew nor rain these years, except by my word. And the word of the Lord came to him, depart from here and turn eastward and hide yourself at the brook Cherith, which is east of the Jordan. And you shall drink from the brook which I have commanded you, and the ravens will feed you there. So he went and did according to the word of the Lord, and he went and lived by the brook east of the Jordan. And the ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And after a while, the brook dried up because there was no rain in the land. Now, I want you to know that one of the questions I asked you is, can God sustain life regardless of the boundaries or the circumstances in your life? Now, it should be no surprise to you that God sustains his person in the argument. Right? This is Elijah. Go hide. There's gonna be a drought, and you go here, and I'm gonna take care of it. You're gonna get fed. Now, there's a lot of things going on in the story, though, behind the scenes. Do you know anything about a people of God that were out in the desert that got fed bread and meat? Nothing like that happened in the Exodus or anything like that. But Elisha gets a double portion. God is starting to pour his blessing. He's still trying to pour his blessings out on his people. And it should be no surprise that God's people are sustained in difficult circumstances. Should it? That shouldn't be a surprise. But here it is, a double portion every day. And he uses ravens, because ravens are lovely, wonderful birds that we just love, and they're fabulous throughout the text. If you look at ravens throughout the Bible, it even says at one spot in Daniel, even the ravens are allowed to take root, take cover under the king. It's sort of like yeast works its way through a whole batch. You know, the Bible uses yeast as a negative example a lot, except for the times when it doesn't. But ravens, so God's going to command the ravens. God's in charge, and he's going to sustain his people. But here's the next piece of this. Then the word of the Lord came to him and said, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, the center point of Baal worship, and dwell there. And behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, a woman was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel that I might drink. And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, oh, and bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. And she said, as the Lord your God, not the Lord my God, that's this little piece of the text. As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour and a jar with a little bit of oil in the jug. And now I am gathering a couple of sticks that I can go prepare it and my son, for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. They're at their end of their rope. They're not God's people. This is Baal's people. And more than that, it's in Baal's territory. And their whole view is that deities are in charge of their boundaries. But Baal has started to invade Yahweh's territory in the northern kingdom. And here is God outside his border doing what? He's starting to talk to a woman. And Elijah said to her, don't fear, go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake and bring it, and afterward make something for yourself and your son. For thus the Lord, the God of Israel, says, the jar of flour shall not be spent, and the jug of oil will not be empty until the day of the Lord sends rain upon this earth. And she went and did as Elijah said, and she and her household ate for many days. The jar of flour was not spent, and neither was the jug of oil empty, according to the word of the Lord through Elijah. Now there's two Sidonian women in this story, Jezebel, who's bringing in Baal worship, and this widow. They're outside of God's borders. Can God sustain life across a boundary like that? Yes, he does. He sustains it outside of God's people. Yes. How about somebody just like Jezebel? A byword, a negative thought in the body of faith, somebody that goes against it. How about somebody that's exactly like her? Can God sustain life that way? Yes. And here it is, even at the end of her life, God gives her a future. She's ready to die, and she needs a future too. And God is doing that. Now, she is not a person of faith at this point. I want you to recognize that. She's actually sitting there going, I'm just going to eat a little bit, and then we're going to lay down and die. You know what that means? My future's over. But God can sustain her. How different is this, that God is saving the woman's son, her future, her chance to live, when Hiel is killing his own kids to build a city that God said don't rebuild. There's these little brackets, these little nudges in the text to say this is not the way that God's going when the others are doing it, but God is saving lives and doing this sort of thing and speaking life. But you've got a country here and a couple of countries that are headlong on the journey. They've got a breakneck pace toward death coming. How many of you have been on that journey? You don't have to raise your hand. I'll just raise mine for you. I've been on that journey. God wants to stop your headlong rush into that negative future. But here it is. The son dies. Here's the moment of faith for the widow. After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God, that you have come to me to bring my sins to remembrance and to cause the death of my son?" Now, don't forget for a moment that the son was as good a dead when Elijah got there, and that she got however long extra with him, but now he's dead. Have you ever noticed, though, that wherever you are, the sins of the people around you, they start blaming you for judging them when you didn't ever say anything because you didn't do it the sinful way, and you cause that to come up into their head, into their memory, and go, "Oh, I hate it when I do that, but it's really this person's fault because they're judging me." When really that's an internal judgment 90% of the time. The presence of God's people living godly lives leads people to remember their own sins because God is a light to the nations through us. And he said to her, "Give me your son." And he took him from her and from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him down on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, why have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son?" And then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord, give me this child's life. Come into him again." And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper chamber into the house and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives." The woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God, and the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth." Now it's not your God, the word of your God anymore. It's the word of the Lord. This is a dramatic change in her life. Even if it's just a little word in the text, I want you to know that something else has happened here. God has reached through a different boundary to sustain life than a geographical boundary, hasn't he? Do you have some boundaries in your life that you don't think God can get through? Well, if you think they're as bad as death, maybe your understanding of your own personal boundaries is a little too strong. But you could be drawing lines around this part of your life. I've met lots of people, they live lives of Sunday Christianity and Monday business. And they've drawn a little life around them. And God can sustain life across those boundaries, but he's going to interrupt those boundaries to do it. And he did here. He reached through death. Even Baal can't, in their tradition, bring water to the earth through a drought without dying at the location of the god Mot. You might not have known that. But Baal needs to go get help and die in order to bring rain. Yahweh, Lord of life, does not need to do that. He can sustain life across any of our boundaries, and he does it easily. But before that, he's going to interrupt the head of steam you have. I just have one little thing about whether or not you're willing to be interrupted. And then I'm all done. And this will be that, okay? Here we go. You think... maybe not you particular, y'all or them or somebody like that, thinks that God's going to interrupt their life and they're going to have to stop having fun and go live lives of the dour, black suit wearing, bony finger of indignation wagging, TV caricaturation of Christianity. And I even thought that when I was a wild child, that I wasn't going to get to have any fun anymore, that I was going to get to continue. If I came to Christ, I would have to change my life, and I wasn't going to get to do the fun stuff anymore. But let me tell you that my headlong path, my head of steam, my locomotive without brakes was not heading to life. It was heading to death. And God interrupts that with life. He interrupts your wages of sin, the wages of sin is death, with life. When he puts his hand in your chest and says, whoa, you're not going to like that destination, it's not to end your life, it's to give you life. And he can reach through your little boundaries. He can reach through your big boundaries. He can reach through your big, whopping, massive, nothing can ever get through this boundary, ever boundaries, to interrupt you with life. And a life that's not pressed down, bony finger of indignation, sallow-cheeked, I'm not having any fun life. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about a life of love and care for those around you that just overflows, that changes you. Well, certainly, maybe you're going to have to give up some activities. I had to give up throwing up into toilets more often. Congratulations to me. I'm just being honest with you. I was a wild child. I've not hidden that from you. But when you go to WSU and you live in a fraternity and you don't know Jesus, some things are going to go on that are not so pretty. And I know what my headlong trip into death was interrupted by. I know that he put his hand in my chest and goes, you're not going to like that destination. How about this one? And gave me life. And a life to be lived fully of love and care. Are you willing to be interrupted with life? Are you? Cool. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I thank you so much for your love, for your care for us, the way that you give examples throughout, even the Old Testament, with that big old grumpy God that interrupts us with life. Should we all be this grumpy? In your precious name, amen.